Good afternoon. You're very welcome to today's edition of Saturday with Clare Byrne. On today's programme, repossession letters are sent out by Ulster Bank. Will changes outlined this week really result in more homeowners losing their property? Luke Ming Flanagan and the penalty point saga. Where does his political career lie at the end of a very eventful week for the independent TD? Also, we hear more about the arrest and release of alleged kidnap victim, the businessman Kevin McGeever. But first, the news with Michael Murphy.
Good afternoon from the newsroom. The headlines. A Roman Catholic cardinal has provoked controversy by describing paedophilia as an illness and not a criminal condition. Pope Francis has said that serving the poor will become a hallmark of his papacy. And in rugby, Ireland completes its Six Nations Championship with an encounter against Italy in Rome this afternoon. Survivors of sexual abuse have reacted angrily to a comment by a Roman Catholic cardinal that paedophilia is an illness and not a criminal condition. Cardinal Wilfred Fox Napier, the Archbishop of Durban in South Africa, made the remarks in a BBC interview. Jackie Fox reports.
Cardinal Fox Napier, who took part in the election of Pope Francis, was asked what the new pontiff could do to repair damage to the Catholic Church's reputation caused by the way it dealt with sexual abuse by priests. He said paedophilia was an illness, not a criminal condition, and questioned whether someone with such psychological defect automatically deserved to be punished.
If I, as a normal being, choose to break the law, knowing that I'm breaking the law, then I think I need to be punished. But if you tell me that somebody who's got a psychological condition, from my experience, paedophilia is actually an illness. It's not a criminal condition, it's an illness.
A spokesperson for the Rape Crisis Network, Kalina Sadler, said they find the comments of Cardinal Fox Napier unhelpful.
It's important to remember that this is a crime and there is a victim to that crime. The psychiatric categorisation of the person who perpetrates that crime really doesn't add anything to that discourse.
Pope Francis has said his mission should be focused on serving the poor. In an address to journalists, the pontiff said he chose to call himself after St. Francis of Assisi, the saint who was a symbol of peace, austerity and service to the poor. From Rome, our religious and social affairs correspondent, Joe Little.
A rapturous applause from many of the 4,000 media workers present in the Vatican audience hall greeted the 76-year-old Pope. To their delight, he departed from script, describing how the Brazilian Cardinal Claudio Humes reminded him not to forget the poor as he congratulated his Argentine neighbour on his election at Wednesday's conclave. The Pope said this prompted his decision to take the name Francis after St. Francis of Assisi, who he described as the man who gives us the spirit of peace, a poor man. He continued, "How I would like a poor church and a church for the poor." Joe Little, RTE News at the Vatican.
In sport, Ireland play the final game of the Six Nations campaign in Rome this afternoon. A speculation continues about the futures of Brian O'Driscoll and coach Declan Kidney. Ireland are seeking to end the tournament with a victory. Kick-off is at 2:30 Irish time. From Rome, Claire McNamara reports.
This campaign began in Cardiff last month with an impressive Irish performance that led to hopes of championship silverware. However, defeats against England and Scotland and last week's draw with France means Ireland is now fighting for a mid-table placing. Along the way, the squad has been hit by an unprecedented run of injuries. The latest coming on Thursday, when out-half Jonathan Sexton was hit by a fresh injury after being named in the team. Brian O'Driscoll has been declared fit to take his place in what could be his last Six Nations game, though the legendary centre insists he hasn't yet made up his mind. The future of coach Declan Kidney is also uncertain. His contract runs out in the summer and he has refused to give any hints about whether or not he'll seek an extension. Ireland face an Italian side that performed very well against Grand Slam chasing England at Twickenham last weekend. Of course, there's also Lions places to play for, as Ireland seek to end on a high in front of a sell-out crowd at the Olympic Stadium. Claire McNamara, RTE News, Rome.
The time is 5 minutes past one, and the weather forecast. There'll be sunny spells and showers this afternoon. Mist and fog will persist in some Midland areas. It'll be cool, with highest temperatures ranging 4 to 8 degrees. And there's a warning that northerly winds will reach gale force tonight and tomorrow on coasts from Mizenhead to Slinehead to Malinhead. Back now to Clare.
Michael, thank you very much. This is Saturday with Clare Byrne. You can get in touch by texting us on 51551. Email saturday@rte.ie and the Twitter address is @SaturdayRTE. On the show today, we're joined in studio by Alan Farrell, Fine Gael TD for Dublin Fingal. Thomas Pringle, Independent TD for Donegal South West, is in our Donegal studio. George Mordaunt, businessman and author, is with us here in Dublin, as is Brendan Burgess from askaboutmoney.com. And Brendan was a member of the previous government's expert group on mortgage arrears. Michael Clifford, columnist with the Examiner and the Sunday Times, is also here. First today, when the white smoke cleared at the end of this week, we were left with a number of stories that probably received less attention than they otherwise might have done given the events in Rome, and it's to one of those we turn now, because the government, along with the central bank and financial regulator, made a fairly major announcement in relation to mortgage arrears this week, setting out measures to help deal with the 120,000 home loans in arrears of 90 days or more. The main points are banks will have to come up with sustainable plans for those who are in arrears or face the possibility of the financial regulator writing down the value of those loans. Those banks who do not meet targets could face other penalties too, and the regulator is also considering changing the rule whereby banks can only contact borrowers in arrears 3 times a month. So Brendan, you first on this one. What will be the impact of this plan, do you reckon?
There'll be a few impacts. I mean, the first most obvious one is that repossessions are going to rise significantly. And let's be clear, that's a very good thing. OK, there are a lot of people out there who are strategic defaulters, and hopefully they will have their homes taken from them. So that's good. Or else they'd be forced.
How many people are brazen enough to be strategic defaulters, just to be earning a living? Yeah. Do you know what
I'm
not
bothering? We've about 74,000 households in arrears over 90 days. And I'm guessing somewhere around 10%, 15% of that. So somewhere around 7,500 to 10,000 people of households.
We don't know for sure, though.
We don't know for sure. But that sort of order of things. Now, some of those are going to suddenly realise, this isn't working. You know, I might lose my home, and they start paying up. So that's good. There are other people then who are genuinely in unsustainable mortgages. There's just no way, restructuring won't work for them, and they will have to sell their house and move into other accommodation. And what I would like to see is that the settlement that they get is that they lose their house. The house is sold in a proper manner. But if they have been working for 3 years, to try and resolve the issue, the shortfall should be written off and they should get a fresh start.
That's the big question, isn't it? If you lose your property, are you still going to be paying back a massive debt for years to come?
Yeah, and if somebody, as I say, has been engaging properly with the banks for the last 3 years or so, they should be allowed a fresh start immediately. This bill or this new plan doesn't deal with that at all, which is disappointing. I mean, the real thing that is missing is that the government's approach to home loans has been the exact same as their approach to buy-to-lets and other loans. So the personal insolvency legislation, the personal insolvency arrangement applies to somebody who has a loan of 2.9 million as much as it does to somebody who has a loan of 300,000. And the government have missed that trick. They really should have said, for people who are in their homes and just their homes, somebody should be appointed, some sort of judge, ombudsman, arbitrator, whatever, who will sit down, look at both sides of the case and will make a binding decision. Either, this would be binding on both the bank and the borrower. It may well be, look, your mortgage is obviously unsustainable. You must move out of the house, or this mortgage needs to be restructured. That's what should have been done. It should have been done in the Personal Insolvency Act. It wasn't done. So, as I say, the ordinary borrower is getting the same treatment as somebody who owes up to 3 million euro.
From the point of view of the banks, though, given the way the property market is at the moment, surely the last thing they would want to do is to repossess a house that they can sell for a pittance, if at all.
Absolutely
it would be
not.
In their interest to restructure that mortgage.
This argument is used a lot. And it is in the bank's interest to restructure mortgages, and the banks have been restructuring mortgages and they will continue to do so. And that's one of the good things about this action. It will encourage the banks to restructure more. So that is a good thing. But, it's very clear the banks want people off tracker mortgages. So this will give big encouragement to the banks to say look, Brendan, I'm really sorry. We'd love to do a deal with you, but we have a target here to meet, and we can't do a deal that meets your requirement and ours, so sorry, you've got to sell the home. That's going to happen to a lot of tracker mortgages, particularly buy-to-let trackers. There are also about 20% of people who are in arrears actually have positive equity in their home. So the bank can repossess their home, sell the house, and the mortgage will be paid off in full. And I can be quite sure if I was a banker and I have a target to meet, I will be going after the people where I'm going to get the most money from.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I suspect the banks will go after the people who are strategic defaulters, but they'll probably go after the easier targets, and that's what I'm most worried about.
George Mordaunt, you just to remind people of your own story, first of all, you entered a debt resolution process with your bank when you got into difficulty, right?
I'm currently in one, just coming to the end of a 3-year cycle, yeah.
And your view on what we heard
this week? It's completely opposite to what Brendan has said. For me, a couple of things, three things. First of all, I'm currently going through the process, and I want to park that for a second. I also have a counselling service in Clonmel, which is called Insight. So I'd like to talk about the people that I'm working with on a multitude of banks. There's absolutely a desire for banks to take the family home. Absolutely a desire for banks to take the family home.
I'm sorry, maybe I was misunderstood or I said it wrong. The banks will take the family home when they can. Generally speaking, they'll work with people to stay in the family home.
But that's not what we're hearing in the media.
I put the question to Brendan that banks would not want to take a home that is of very little value in comparison to the amount of money that was borrowed to buy
it. The value of the house is not coming into it. My experience of dealing with lots of people in different banks is very simply the moral hazard box that's on the form that the bank official is filling out. There's two issues here, Claire.
You kept your home, by the way, right? You kept your family home.
Well, I'm going through the process right now of dealing with my own resolution, so everything is on the table for discussion. And that's all I can say to you about that. And remember that I have a commitment to sign a non-disclosure agreement, so it's difficult for me to talk about my personal circumstances. But here's what I can tell you that I know and that I've seen over the last 7 or 8 months. First of all, there are two types of borrowers, Brendan, that I'm seeing at the moment. There are people with, you know, mortgage arrears, and that's fine. And then there are people with commercial loans, buy-to-lets, and as a result of the strain that those properties are causing, have now got mortgage arrears. And just to deal with those people first, there are lots of people out there who made a commercial punt, bought a couple of buy-to-lets, are struggling with those, cannot afford to pay their own mortgage. In that circumstances, what I'm seeing from banks is that you absolutely have got to put your family home on the table. And a lot of the banks are coming up with the idea that there is an appropriate sized home, and the word appropriate is key here. An appropriate sized home would be, for example, a husband and wife with two kids, that would be a 3-bedroom semi-D. An appropriate sized dwelling for somebody that's retired and over the age of 70 or 75 would be a 2-bedroom apartment. This is the raw facts of what's going on.
Sorry, George,
the
what's wrong with a 3-bedroom semi-D? As I understand it, and I'm open to correction, you're living in what would be called a trophy home.
Me?
You have cost the Irish taxpayer, I think, many millions of euro. Your business has gone bust. That can happen to anybody. I think it's gone bust. You've got huge personal loans on a number.
Wrong on every count, Brendan. Sorry, I don't know who's doing your research, but you're completely wrong. And I don't think the conversation is about me, because for me, I'm leaving George Mordaunt to one side for a second. Let me just finish my point.
Hold on a second. You're living in a trophy home, and
how
you have
do you
not
know
lost
I'm living in a trophy
debt.
Home?
I know you're living in a trophy home.
How do you know
it's
you're living in a trophy home?
Where you're living in you're living in Clonmel in a trophy home.
Totally incorrect. This debate today, this conversation today.
Are you living in a modest semi-3D? And if you're living in a modest semi-3D, I apologise.
Brendan,
with all due respect,
back up for a second. This debate today isn't about George Mordaunt. I'm handcuffed in terms of what I can say today. I've signed a non-disclosure agreement or have a commitment to do so. This is about what I know of the debt resolution programme that people are going through.
And
that's what I'd like to talk about.
Fair enough. If you can't talk about his personal circumstances, you know, and can't respond to your criticism.
I'm quite stunned, actually, Claire. I'm very stunned, Brendan, that I'm sorry, you're on national radio, and I'm shocked that you have said what you've said to the people that are listening, particularly the people in Clonmel today.
My main concern is for people who have modest homes, who are at risk of losing them. If somebody has borrowed to buy lots of property, if somebody has extensive businesses well beyond the 3 million euro limit, for example, in the Personal Solvency Act, their family home should be on the table, and they should be living in a home appropriate. And it doesn't matter whether they've been living in a big home in the past or not. if they have, that should be sold and they should be living in a modest family home. And there's nothing at all wrong with a three-bedroom semi-detached for a couple with two
children.
Claire,
you asked me a question. I'd like to answer the question.
Yeah, can I ask you about strategic defaulters? Because Brendan says that there are about 15% of people who are in arrears who are, in his view, strategic defaulters. Now, you deal with people on a daily basis who come to you for advice. Are there people who won't pay?
I haven't met one strategic defaulter in my life, ever. None. What I'm meeting on a daily basis is people who, you know, have three buy-to-let houses, who have two teenage kids, who have a job. Like, I met a guy recently, right, who has three houses and one apartment in France, part of some investment that he made in terms of holiday apartments. He borrowed for one of those houses and two credit unions, 60,000 in one and 40 in the other, unsecured debt. You know, that's the type of person that I'm meeting. And what I'm saying to you is that the bank, you know, are looking after the taxpayer, and correctly so. And when it comes to having the conversation about resolving the debt, there is a process, and a very intrusive process, bordering on intruding on people's civil rights in terms of resolving the debt. And the family home is very much on the table, because what I'm saying to you is that I'm listening to politicians talking and I'm watching the media, and they're saying, as you said a couple of minutes ago, Brendan, that the family home, you know, banks will do everything in their power to keep people in the home. That's not what I'm experiencing. It's just simply not what I'm experiencing.
In modest family homes, they are. In very large homes, they're not. Would you agree that people in very large homes, say worth over €300,000 or €500,000, that those homes should be sold and the proceeds used where people are otherwise insolvent? Would you agree with that? Yes or no?
I would say to you that no. Because everything is bespoke to the individual. Everything is created around the individual. And I don't think kids should be made to move out of their bedrooms and strip their posters off their walls. I think there are other solutions.
Well, I'm sorry, but I do think but that Brandon, people living in houses worth more than 500,000 should have...
Depends on where the house is.
But they owe €750,000 on it, Brendan. What about that situation? And they're willing to pay and they're up to date with their mortgage.
Well, sorry,
interest and capital.
Sorry,
what happens then?
Sorry, if somebody's up to date with their mortgage, well then, of course, they won't be in this situation.
Rubbish. This is not... You are completely misunderstanding.
People,
this is incorrect.
People who have huge loans which they are unable to pay, who are seeking resolutions with their lender, should be putting their family home on the market if it's worth more than €500,000. And there are plenty of homes that they can move into and rent for a lot less than servicing those costs. I mean, you know, we're talking about somebody has to pay. I don't want to. I'm happy enough to pay rent allowance and mortgage interest supplement for a couple who are unemployed and living in a modest home. I'm not prepared to put more money into AIB and EBS and PTSB to keep people in homes,
in big homes.
I think most people listening would agree with that. Alan Farrell,
where do you stand on this moral dilemma, the family home?
Well, part of the government announcement that was made during the week and also that of the central bank and the financial regulator is primarily to keep people in their family homes. I mean, the primary target is to get borrowers who are in distress into negotiations with their financial institutions, with the six banks, for
people
the purposes...
But people like Brendan don't want to pay to have people stay in expensive homes.
I don't think there's a question of individuals who are not in arrears or not in financial difficulty entering into any form of arrangement purely on the basis that their property has a certain value. What we're talking about is homeowners who are in financial distress due to large overhanging mortgages on properties that are clearly not in any way up to
the value of the mortgage. Anyone's suggesting that
there's
if you weren't in trouble in financial difficulty, you'd be asked to move out of your home.
Well, there's 95,000.
That's actually
paying,
what's happening. That's actually what's happening.
People in mortgage arrears.
I just want to clarify this. You might be paying your mortgage on your family home, but you might be in big trouble with a buy-to-let mortgage elsewhere. And then everything is on the table, to you.
People that are paying interest and capital that have never missed a payment on their family home, irrespective of the value of it, irrespective of the size of it, are being asked in certain situations to downsize.
Because they're in trouble elsewhere financially.
To downsize, even though there's no recourse to the family home. And in that situation, there are creative solutions around that situation where the taxpayer can be looked after and the individuals get to stay in their home, an extra encumbrance on the house,
for example. With the greatest respect, George, if I can come in there. Now, what you're referring to is where individuals who may or may not have personal guarantees in place, whose own financial portfolio is with a given bank, And the loan, one or all of their loans are in distress. I think that is the scenario that you're outlining. The point that that this particular move by government and by the central bank are taking is that the homeowners who are in mortgage distress, the 94,500 homes that are in excess of 90 days, 25% who are in arrears for over 2 years, are being encouraged to go to the banks with the targets that have been set that Claire mentioned at the top of the show in terms of 20% by the end of June, 30%, 20% by the end of September and 50% by the end of December of this year, the balance of which will be dealt with in 2014. But the purpose of this is a carrot for both borrower and, of course, the banks who have not been engaging in a reasonable manner with those who are in mortgage arrears. And, of course, we do have the issue of repossessions, which has been mentioned. The purpose of the other step that we are taking in the Oireachtas with the view to amending the Conveyancing Act of 2009, which has been found to have a flaw in it by way of
the
High Court judgment, mm-hmm. indeed, Justice Dunn, earlier, or in 2011.
So you're going to fix that so that repossessions are out.
Well, this is it.
I'm conscious that we haven't heard from Thomas Pringle yet, who's in our Donegal studio. Thomas, is it not better to face the problem by putting some pressure on the banks rather than just string it out as we have been doing?
Exactly, and I think the reason that we're in the situation today, Claire, is that we haven't been addressing the problem, and the banks certainly haven't been addressing it. They've been content to sit on the capital that they have and allow the situation to drag on and drag on and give the appearance that they are actually dealing with people, where we see that they talk about a restructured mortgage as being something simply where somebody is put on interest only for 6 months. And then when they come off that again, they end up in a default situation again within a couple of months.
So you would welcome the development then this week where we've got to have a sustainable restructured loan situation for borrowers?
Well, if that was the developments we had this week, I would welcome it. But I think all we've had this week is a restatement of what the government has been saying for the last number of years. And we have no actual policy development at all. I think if the government were serious about forcing the banks to deal with this issue and to deal with homeowners in terms of debt restructuring and trying to protect them in their family homes, the government would be saying that we will not amend the 2009 Conveyancing Act until you show us that you are actively dealing with your clients and your customers. And that's the stick that the banks will understand.
So how do you feel about those who are in trouble with buy-to-let mortgages, people who probably should never have bought those homes in the first place? I mean, do you think they should be allowed to hold on to those properties even though they've got no chance of paying that money back?
No, I don't. I think that people who invested in buy-to-let properties, they were conned throughout the period of the bubble. They were conned by financial institutions, by the political system, and they were encouraged to get into this unsustainable property bubble.
But the Dunn judgment has to be changed to cater for repossessions in those cases as well. So
yes, but the banks also need to be forced to restructure, and the banks need to be forced to deal proactively with people who are want to stay in their family homes and attempt to deal with the debt problem that they have. But it has to be realistic, and it has to be, I mean, it's very interesting in the conversation today, and the conversation we hear at all times is about this idea of moral hazard, and how moral hazard only comes into play when we talk about people living in the family home and people who are struggling to keep a roof over their heads. There's no mention of moral hazards when we talk about the billions of euros that we've pumped into the banks to allow them to continue on and do what they're doing, and where the banks are clearly still calling the shots.
Michael Clifford, you've been listening to this debate thus far. What's your view on what happened this week? Does it move us on, do you think?
It moves it on a bit, but I would have some reservations about it. In particular, I mean, the thing is so complicated. I mean, if you look at it, for instance, what about the most people who would have problems with their mortgage? They're also of unsecured creditors, like, for instance, credit unions and that. So where does that leave them if the focus is going to be on tackling the mortgage crisis with the money they owe to banks? Another problem I have with it is it's targets only, and the sanctions that are supposed to be there if the targets aren't met, for instance, increased capital requirements and the writing down of loans. Now, in the case of AIB and permanent TSB, the cost of that is going to fall back on the state nearly entirely. So, you know, that's no skin off the bank's nose, effectively. And then the other issue is about people who want to park the loans where they're allowed to do interest only and park it for a number of years. Now, as I understand it, AIB are not charging interest on the money that's being parked, but Bank of Ireland is, and I think Permanent TSB is as well. Now, there's a situation where the government could put far more pressure to ensure that interest isn't charged in those instances.
So say, if you owe 300,000, you can park half of that for 25 years. Some banks are charging interest on the parked bit, and some aren't.
And some aren't, and I think that's large. In terms of the whole business of repossessions, I mean, I understand what Brendan's talking about trophy homes, but there is a primal attachment to the family home. I mean, for instance, I know people who during the boom, they moved into bigger homes for their families, and somebody like Brendan or myself may regard it as a trophy home, to use that expression, but to them it's their family home. So to my mind, any movement to try and alleviate the problem should begin in the buy-to-let market. And the key thing there is, and I think Brendan alluded to it earlier, is if you hand back the keys, and I think this really should apply in the buy-to-let market and get that whole thing out of the way in the first instance, if you hand back the keys, the debt's done. You give the bank back the house and your debt is wiped. If that...
But someone has to repay that money. And as you said earlier on, it'll probably in many cases be the taxpayer.
That's very likely too. But I mean, is that the hit that you take in order to move that element of the problem along? And I think a lot of it comes down to that.
Can I clarify that the debt should be written off, in my view, only on the family home? On the buy-to-lets, it's a much more complicated issue, and I'd be very slow to say there should be a general rule that shortfalls on buy-to-lets should be written off. Can I make one other very important point here, which maybe Alan might like to address? This new plan that comes in does not apply to the four lenders with the highest levels of arrears. Bank of Scotland and Start Mortgages. Bank of Scotland were the biggest lender at the time of the boom, and Start Mortgages are a subprime lender. But nor does it apply to the former borrowers from Irish Nationwide who are now with the IBRC. There are no targets for IBRC to resolve the problems, and 50% of their loans are in arrears. And the biggest subprime lender of them all was the local authorities. And the local authorities are under no obligations, as far as I know, to restructure any mortgages.
Alan, that's
25% of the arrears.
That's a big problem, isn't it, that those four institutions are not part of this plan?
Well, certainly there are a number of institutions that are outside of the scope of this proposal. The suite of measures that the government are proposing to attempt to resolve mortgage arrears across the country will primarily target, as I've mentioned already, those within the categories set out, the 3, 6 and 9 month up to the end of the year, and then the balance in 2014. There are a number of institutions that are outside of this. The IABRC issue is an interesting one, which I would imagine will resolve itself once we have the loan book is passed on to an institution. I would have to say the chances are it may well be one of the six that's covered by this proposal. So you know, we won't be discussing
this is the
it
stuff
in any...
that you can't sell that nobody wants.
Certainly there are institutions. You know, let's be honest with one another that there's a large cohort of debt that is with IBRC. Or with the special liquidator who's having to deal with that on all of our behalves, and the best solution for that is to sell the loan book for the purposes of ensuring that the expertise is employed within a financial institution for the purposes of getting that debt repaid
that
as much as possible.
The bits that you can't sell. George, you wanted to come in there earlier.
Yeah, just on a mortgage. When you have a mortgage on a house, even if it's a buy-to-let, it almost acts as a personal guarantee. So the recourse is fully to the individual. So in terms of writing off the debt, or the debt stopping with the buy-to-let, that isn't the case. I've learned that the hard way. Mm. Second of all, just to say to you that I think it's very important just to stress as well that one of the points I want to make today is that the communication from the media, through the media from the government, is not consistent with what's happening on the ground. To give you an idea of how complicated this is, an individual who has one loan for €1 million, which came home at €500,000, leaving a €500,000 balance of debt owing, to one of the pillar banks, was asked to sell his home, which is in negative equity and borrowed through Ulster Bank. He was asked to go and consult with Ulster Bank about the process of selling his home, right, so that the other pillar bank could provide an appropriate mortgage for him. That is the depth of...
I think, George, with the greatest of respect, I think at the start of the show you mentioned that because you were in the process of a financial resolution yourself, it wasn't possible to talk about your own circumstances. And I think equally, when you throw in a scenario like that,
yeah,
which, you know, you're mentioning on the national airwaves, which you made another point about earlier on, I think it's very, very difficult for clarity to be given on such an example. I have no basis to believe that that sort of approach is being taken. I've spoken with the chief executives of both Bank of Ireland and AIB over the last 18 months, and they have not outlined any such scenarios occurring. But the point I'm making, the point I'm making, George, the point I'm making, George,
is in this situation. The point I'm making is that why I'm here today. I believe I'm here today to share my experiences of people that I'm meeting on a daily basis.
But I think it's very easy. I think it's very easy to throw in a comment like that, where, you know, where somebody sells a property to pay off €1 million debt, is left with €500,000. That debt is still owing.
You're missing the point, Alan.
Part
his house is in negative equity, so selling the house doesn't improve the financial position at all.
I think there's one issue that comes out of all of this, and that there is very much, I mean, George is speaking in one vein, and anecdotally I've heard some similar tales, but only anecdotally, because the banks operate behind closed doors. The impression we're getting from the leading people in the banks, and to a certain extent from the government, is very different as to how the banks are dealing with people who are in arrears,
exactly,
and with creditors. And their needs, there really would need to be some clarity there, because we're getting two completely different... It's very similar to the pictures we're getting from the banks between what they're doing in terms of lending out to small business and the picture we're getting from small business organisations.
George says, and George, you can say this yourself, but I mean, the people you deal with, there isn't even consistency within the banks as to how they deal
That's
with
the
clients,
issue. Yeah.
Let alone across
and
the
sometimes in the same institution,
the
Claire.
Industry.
You know, dealing with somebody in Navan, in AIB, for example, could be different to dealing with a client who's dealing with AIB in Cork. There is, you're 100% right, Mick, there's huge inconsistency. And that's the point. There's only two points I wanted to make today. One is the inconsistent message that's coming out. And the other is that the family home is not as protected as Michael Noonan is leading us to believe, as Alan Shatter is leading us to believe. And I want people to understand today when they're listening, not only have I gone through it myself, but I've seen it on hundreds of cases where every time the individual walks in for the final part of the resolution, having liquidated assets, you know, for 6 and 18 months beforehand, to then find out that we now look at your family home. And it should be looked at. I'm under no illusions there. It should be looked at. And the client has to feel very considerable pain, which they are. The point I wish to make is that that client can feel that pain, and that issue around the family home can be dealt with by leaving them in the home. For example, in some cases, I've seen an extra €200,000 encumbrance being put on the house, a lifetime mortgage. I've seen mortgages being converted to lifetime mortgages for 40 years. I've seen situations where the €200,000 that I talk about, as a second or third mortgage, remains at a zero coupon, not being charged until the original mortgage is paid off, where maybe even when the people die, their estate picks up the tab. I'm not saying that people should walk away with their home under their arm. I'm saying that people should be left in their home, and creative solutions to keep them in the home should be sought.
But would you understand the problem of ordinary people who see people living in very large homes? They know that they've had debts written off in whatever way, whether, like, I mean, there was a fuss about people who went to the UK, went bankrupt, and seemed to be managed to live in their family homes back here in Ireland and stuff like that. There are other people, and it's known that they're getting their business have gone bust, yet they don't seem affected by it.
Brendan, I don't see a 1,700 really, euro house, a 1,700 square foot house in the middle of Feathered, County Tipperary, which is a little village. I don't see that as a trophy home.
I'm not
home.
Sure about which particular
house. Yeah, but you know what I'm saying?
But the general...
But you know what I'm saying? Aylesbury Road is a trophy home.
Oh, yeah, but there's trophy homes all over the place.
You know, there's lots of trophy homes.
If I can, and it's something I've been thinking about. I mean, you know, a three-bedroom semi down the street in Donnybrook might be considered a bit of a trophy home for a three-bed semi homeowner in Coolock, for instance, yeah, or whatever, or inner city Cork. Let's be honest with one another about this discussion. I think it's gone off in a tangent, and I don't think it's the core issue. But okay, can I just talk about the insolvency legislation and the
briefly,
and the
Alan.
Insolvency Service of Ireland, which is in the process of being set up. I mean, nobody wants to see anybody put out of their family home. Then the purpose of part of the announcement that has been made is to encourage the banks to engage in and meaningful discussions with debtors for the purposes of coming to a resolution. If that solution results in an unsustainable debt or continuation of an unsustainable debt for a borrower, well, then there are options like scenarios where they would become a tenant, either of the local authority and or the lease options, which are being looked at as well. So there are a number of options available for those who have unsustainable debt.
I'm going to move on because we're going to go to a story now that we hadn't planned on addressing. It's a breaking story. Cyprus, the latest country to enter the bailout programme, and the terms and the conditions of the bailout is causing consternation on the island today. Carl Whelan, Professor of Economics in UCD, is on the line now. Carl, there's a provision in here which is very interesting, and it'll be news to many, particularly as we had a bailout from the same source and we weren't subject to this levy. Tell us about the 10% on bank deposits.
Well, the condition of the new bailout deal that's been arranged for Cyprus is that there is a levy being imposed on all bank depositors. If you are lucky enough to have money in the bank over 100,000, the levy is 10% on every amount over 100,000. But probably of more interest to most listeners is the fact that people in Cyprus with under 100,000 in their deposits are going to be hit with a levy of 6.75%.
Now, the banks, I understand, at least some of them have closed in Cyprus today because people are rushing in to take their money, but are still queuing up at ATMs to make withdrawals before this comes into force next Tuesday. Why has Cyprus been subject to this levy?
Well, Cyprus's banks it's been known that the banks are bust for quite some time. And when a package was put together, or when numbers were put together as to how much Cyprus would need to be able to make its banks fully solvent and be able to pay off all their liabilities and be good for honouring those deposits, it turned out that Cyprus was going to need $17 billion. Now, that's not a lot of money relative to, you know, the euro area's GDP or anything like that, but that's 100% of Cyprus's GDP. So they wouldn't have been able to take on all that new debt and be able to pay back their existing sovereign bonds. So really you had three options. One was that Cyprus would default on its existing debt to take on this new debt. The other was that the euro area would basically give it the $17 billion or give it much of it and not expect to get it back. That would be a pure bailout. And then the third option was to accept that the banks are bust and that they can't pay people back. Now, you might imagine that the first people that would get hit here would be bondholders, but Cyprus's banks don't have many bondholders. They only have a small amount. But even then, Cyprus's bondholders are not being hit by this levy. It is purely depositors that are being hit.
So if you are a person who has a large amount of money on deposit in any Eurozone institution, with any Eurozone institution, should you be worried?
I think in general, you shouldn't be. The situation in Cyprus is extremely special. Cyprus has its very large banking sector relative to its GDP, and that's partly because a lot of Russian money has come into Cyprus, and there are various rumors about Cyprus not keeping up with the appropriate money laundering rules and so on. But I still think this is a really worrying development, even though, you know, most people, like people listening at home, you know, might get worried that this could happen. But, you know, the Irish banks have had their crisis and they've been recapitalized and they're in good shape. But there are other banks around Europe, you know, like the Spanish banks. People really aren't sure what shape those banks are in. And politicians are going to say now that this was a special case and it can't happen anywhere else. But, you know, even a couple of weeks ago, Cyprus's finance minister was saying that this couldn't happen in Cyprus and that it was, he literally said, this was a stupid option.
So does this have the potential then to trigger a bank run in other Eurozone countries? You mentioned Spain.
I think a lot depends upon how it's handled in the next few days by Europe's politicians. But if you were going to do something designed to cause upset and worry for depositors across Europe, this is what you do. I mean, even the very fact that people with deposits under 100,000 are being hit sends out this signal that when this happens to your country, when this happens to your banks, ordinary people get hit. One might at least have thought that the message that was going to be sent out was Cyprus is a special case and we're really only hitting, you know, the Russian oligarchs that have laundered their money into Cyprus. So I would even hope that this weekend that the Eurozone could reconsider this plan and perhaps formulate it so that ordinary people with regular amounts in Cypriot banks won't get hit with this levy, and they just go and increase the levy above 100,000 or some higher number from 10% to 25% or whatever it needs to be. So I think as currently formulated, it's a worrying plan, and I hope there's time before Tuesday morning to maybe reconsider it.
So you think it might be finessed before it happens on Tuesday, perhaps, once the wisdom of it is considered?
One would hope, although they were up until all hours of the morning last night deciding this plan, and presumably the possibility that it might cause a bit of upset in the rest of Europe was considered. So, but look, I would hope that if it does cause us trouble, that it's reconsidered. And I think that this is a mistake. Also, from the perspective of, you know, of people in Ireland, it's sort of upsetting to see, given the amount of money that was put directly on the Irish taxpayer so that all bank creditors would be bailed out, that now we're seeing very different options pursued, which begs the question, why is it that the Irish taxpayer had to take on so much debt? For, you know, in many ways, Anglo-Irish Bank was not that different from what some of these Cypriot, how some of these Cypriot banks behave, in the sense that it wasn't a retail bank. It had a lot of large foreign corporate deposits, and all of those have been honoured by Ireland. And that was partly because we were repeatedly told you need to pay back all these deposits, because if you don't, it'll be a threat to the financial stability of Europe. Mm-hmm. And now we get this.
Professor Carl Whelan, thank you for joining us today on the programme. We're going to take a quick break. Coming up, Ming Flanagan and the penalty points. Where does his political career go from here? Now, Thomas Pringle, independent TD, is in our Donegal studio today. Michael Clifford, columnist with The Examiner and The Sunday Times, is here in Dublin, along with Alan Farrell, Fine Gael TD. And we move now to the penalty point saga of independent Roscommon South Leitrim TD, Luke Ming Flanagan. Deputy Flanagan was one of four TDs before Christmas who alleged that penalty points had been wiped by Gardaí in 50,000 cases. But it's since emerged that one of those who had points quashed was Ming Flanagan himself, twice. He initially claimed that a Gardaí sergeant and a Roscommon council official had offered to wipe his penalty points, but on an interview on Shannon Side Radio this week, he had this to say.
There's no questioning it. I have let people down. There is no denying that. And for that, and for the people of Ireland, I am sorry. On the issue of the penalty points, it was corrupt what I did. So draw your own conclusions from that.
There you go. That was Luke Ming Flanagan speaking earlier this week on Shannon Side. And we did invite him on the programme via his constituency office, but we didn't get a response. Thomas Pringle, I want to come to you on this first of all. There were reports yesterday that he would be frozen out of the independent technical group, which would impact his speaking rights in the Dáil. Is that the right course of action, do you think?
Well, Claire, it's not even something that we could do, even if it was something that we would wish to do. The technical group, the way it is established under the standing orders of the Dáil, is that any non-party aligned member of the Dáil is entitled to be a member of the technical group. And we have absolutely no say in over who can be or won't be a member of the group. I heard about the reports myself. I wasn't at any meeting that this was allegedly discussed at. And I think every member knows that we have absolutely no control over who can or can't be a member.
But an amendment to a bill has gone forward, which is signed by every member of the technical group except Luke Ming Flanagan. Does that show where he stands with you guys?
Oh, this is on the private members' business for next week. Yeah, I mean, the way the private members' business works is that each member of the group is circulated to them, and if they come back by a certain time to say that they want their name added to it, their name is added to it.
Okay, well, look, let's talk to you about what impact you believe this story has and what Ming Flanagan has done. What impact will it have, do you think, on the independent brand in the Dáil and in politics in Ireland?
Well, I think there's no doubt that it will have an impact on how people view independence, and that's, for, as an independent myself, I find that very disappointing. You know, and it's not something, it's not a situation I'd like to be in at this point in time, having to justify independence. But the thing to remember, and I think that all listeners need to remember, is that while we are independent, we all stood individually on our own platforms and without any common common policy base and separate to each other in our own constituents. So while Ming is an independent, he is accountable only to himself and to the people of Roscommon, and he's not accountable to me or any of the other members of the technical group.
What's your view, though, of somebody who admits being corrupt? Should they continue in public office?
I think somebody who admits being corrupt, and it's proven to be that the corrupt act has taken place, it does call into question their ability to continue on in public office. But in the system that we have in this country, the people are only accountable to their constituents, and it is only the people of the constituency who can adjudicate on whether they want that person to continue as their public representative or not.
But you think he should probably think about it, though, right?
We've seen that over the last not many years in the case of Michael Lowry, who has been tribunals has found against him, and the people of Tipperary continue to re-elect him. So the process that we have, and the democratic process that we have, is that the people of the constituency are the only people who can adjudicate on that issue.
It couldn't have come at a worse time, though, for the independents, because the latest opinion poll numbers show that the number of people who plan to vote for independence has never been higher, really. So you were riding the crest of a wave, and then this happens.
Yeah, and I suppose that's politics. At no time would I like to see any independent member in a situation that Luke has created for himself. And that's obviously, we wouldn't want to see that, and like to see the polls continuing as they are. But as an independent myself, I'll stand on my record and be accountable to my electorate. And that's the only thing that I'll be putting forward when it comes down to election time and being held to account.
Alan Farrell, he did come clean in the end, though.
I'm not sure that it was voluntary, quite frankly. I think the line of questioning over the course of the day led to the position that he found himself in. But I think Thomas Pringle has hit the nail on the head. Luke Flanagan created this for himself by, you know, being a champion or so-called champion of on the penalty points issue and raising it in the Dáil along with the other members of the technical group. And now he finds himself at the other end of the process, having misled the public. You know, he has brought himself into disrepute. I think the comments that he has made over the last few days, particularly his speech during the course of the day where he outlined his own position, was hugely damaging to himself, taken in context with what has been put forward since. I think Deputy Flanagan's standing in his own community has been enormously damaged by this. In fact, I spoke with my colleague Frank Feehan, who's also a deputy in Roscommon, who informed me that a number of his constituents had informed him that, you know, they had taken a major knock in terms of their personal feeling towards Deputy Flanagan.
And there will be, of course, those who still support Ming Flanagan.
Well, most likely there will be. I mean, you know, Deputy Pringle mentioned there the political system that we have in this country in terms of those who have perpetrated wrongdoing, topping the poll the following election or series of elections thereafter. I'm not going to suggest that that would be the case with this instance, but I would certainly think that the people of Roscommon and South Leitrim have a serious problem on their hands in terms of the perception of re-electing somebody who, by their own admission, is corrupt.
Michael Clifford, one of the major issues in this story is the law. The fact that you can use as a defence that you were heading off on Dáil business, and that is in our constitution and you can fall back on it, and it was used by Sean McCarthy in the 1980s when he was arrested on suspicion of drink driving, changed the law.
Yeah, to be honest with you, Claire, I think that's a red herring. I also think this notion, I think Ming is a car crash, the way he's been carrying on all week. But his own suggestion that what he did was corrupt, to be honest with you, I don't find it in any way corrupt. And
why not?
He's guilty of plenty. He's guilty enough that in any other jurisdiction he should resign. But this notion of corruption, because the whole penalty point system, you have to go back to that. There is a system in place whereby there is discretion given to superintendents that if somebody writes them, and I'm talking about somebody, any citizen, and I personally know people, I only found this out when this came to the fore last December, but I know people who have no influence, who didn't know the superintendent, didn't know Gardaí, and they wrote on the basis of what they felt was a legitimate excuse, and they had the points, the penalty points deleted.
But now, those same people didn't stand up in the Dáil and go to a press conference at Buswell's exactly and say the guards are doing X, Y, and Z.
That is precisely my point. That is what he is guilty of. He's not guilty of corruption. It was perfectly open to him, as it was to any citizen, to do as he did. Now, that is a major flaw in the system, and to my mind, that is the reason why we have this whole inquiry and the controversy over the type of people who get their penalty points deleted. A superintendent decides this in his personal judgment behind closed doors. So, for instance, even if it was in open court, a judge would have to weigh up whether the person, for example, had a high public profile or anything. Whatever he does is there in open court. This is behind closed doors. It puts a huge burden, if anything, on the superintendents, and to my mind, that system
That's
is the at
problem.
The heart of the whole thing. So he's not corrupt, but he is guilty of everything else, because the level of hypocrisy, the fact that apart from the hypocrisy, the fact that he came forward with this massive scandal, he kept referring to the Gardaí as corrupt, and then he had information that was central to the type of inquiry that the assistant commissioner was undertaking, and he didn't even go to him with that information. I mean, the whole thing really reflects appallingly on him, but I don't buy this thing of him being corrupt.
You don't think it's corrupt. Thomas Pringle, that's a very valid point that Michael makes, isn't it? That the system is dodgy to begin with.
Yeah, I think, and if Michael's very clear, and it is very clear that the law provides for people to have their penalty points wrote off.
Sorry, that's one thing. I'm not sure, Thomas, if the law provides it. The policy's there. As I understand it, the road traffic accident under which the points are included, I don't think that there's provision in that specific law for it. It is a long-standing policy.
Mm-hmm. Well, either way, there's a practice that penalty points can be written off, and I think the principle that can happen and in a way that is at the discretion of a superintendent certainly seems to be wrong and should be examined and re-examined. I've received penalty points myself and I would never have occurred to me to write to somebody to have
them written
off. You should
have done, especially if you were going to the Dáil or doing any sort of Dáil business.
Absolutely no way, Claire. You know, and I mean, I could argue, as a TD, you could argue that you're on Dáil business 24/7. But, you know, there's absolutely no way that I would, it would even cross my mind to try and have penalty points written off, unless I was completely satisfied in my own mind that they were wrongly added onto me.
And plenty of people do think they're within their rights to make that call. Alan?
One of the points that it must be said in regards to wiping of penalty points, there are legitimate circumstances in which it can occur. For instance, if an individual is rushing somebody to hospital or a scenario like that.
But it should be done in open court or
I don't necessarily disagree with you that it should be written down somewhere and become a formal process, but I'm not sure that bringing it into a court would be a good thing. I mean, you're talking about the last step in the stage, and there's expense to the state, but I do accept the point that you're making.
Okay. But anything that is done has to be done in a transparent manner, and I think that's the point in relation
okay.
to it.
We're going to have to leave that one there. Alan, we're going to say goodbye to you. Thomas Pringle in Donegal, thank you very much as well. But coming up in just a moment, we're going to be talking about the strange tale of Kevin McGeever, the businessman who says he was kidnapped but ended up being questioned by the Gardaí himself. Now, the developer Kevin McGeever, who was found wandering in Leitrim in an emaciated state in January, was released by Gardaí last night. He was questioned for more than 24 hours. John Mooney is a journalist with the Sunday Times and has been following the story. John, you might bring us up to date with what's happened in recent days with Kevin McGeever.
Kevin McGeever was arrested on Thursday and he was taken to Cork Garda Station on suspicion of wasting police time. He was questioned over a 24-hour period and released from custody very late last night. He has since left the Galway area. I understand he's staying at an address in the Midlands. And the Gardaí are now sending a file on his case to the Director of Public Prosecutions. They have also stated that their investigation into his alleged abduction is now concluded.
OK. Now, you had a chat with Kevin quite soon after he came to public attention in February, I think it was. Well, he was found in January, but you spoke to him in February. What did he have to say?
Well, Mr. McGeever is very security conscious. He changes his phones on a regular basis. We managed to contact him in early March and asked about various allegations which had been made against him concerning property transactions he was involved in Dubai and other issues relating to him in America, which sort of surround issues of fraud. He claimed that he had been kidnapped. He said that he was very weak, in fact too weak, to really go into the details of what had happened, but he described it as an ordeal and he stated that he was trying to recover. The only time that he sort of was very forthright about the issues and the allegations against him was when I asked him about allegations against him concerning fraud in America. And at that point, he stated that, well, I don't know what that's about. I haven't been in America for nearly 20 years. Mm-hmm. He seemed to genuinely be perplexed as to that particular allegation. But he declined to comment on any of the other issues that have been and allegations levied against him.
So the mystery remains. Where was he for those 8 months that he was reported missing?
At the moment, that is the situation, yeah.
John, thank you very much. John Mooney there. And Michael, you're a sometime novelist, aren't you?
This is great. This great could, material there.
Couldn't
right,
it yeah. form the basis, the next plot for your book?
From the outset, once this man was discovered, track back over what had happened. I mean, just the type of detail. Immediately, I saw that his partner, I think she said he was missing. I think it was within a month of him disappearing. There was nothing else afterwards. Now, Claire, if you or I went missing, I would certainly hope that my extended family would be kicking up war and saying, where is he? Get the authorities moving. Find this man or whatever. There was none of that for 8 months, despite the fact that since he surfaced, his brother was on, I think it was John Murray's show,
right,
giving an explanation for it. And when he was found, as far as I remember, the person who found him said, she said that he requested initially, don't bring me to the Gardaí.
Mm-hmm.
Initially, so
you want a curry chips, I think. As well.
Yeah, the whole thing is, but it's certainly great material for somebody with an imagination, anyway.
Michael Clifford, thank you, and thank you to all my guests today. That's it from us for this week. We're back next week at 1 o'clock. Happy St. Patrick's Day, and thank you for listening.
Saturday with Claire Byrne was produced by Peter Woods. The researcher was Leslie Anderson, and audio supervision this week was by Noel Roberts.